This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
When it comes crashing down and it hurts inside.
Hulk Hogan. There, I've said it.
You gotta take a stand, it don't have to hide.
Yes, the man of bottled hair and bottled tan, the pro wrestling champ whose face looks like it was pickled in steroids, who has probably made more off of his own sex tape accidentally than almost anyone in history, joins Larry Flint of Hustler as a champion of the First Amendment. Actually, he's a destroyer of the First Amendment. Talking about Hulk Hogan, kind of a milestone in my career, if I may veer into a zone of naive smugness. But the issue of Hogan's sex tape and a successful lawsuit against bottom-feeding news outlet Gawker, a lawsuit bankrolled by internet billionaire Peter Thiel, he founded PayPal, is a serious new twist for the Bill of Rights. Thiel, one of the earliest investors in Facebook, also has his own problems with the company that go way back. ValleyWag, a Gawker-owned site that's since been shuttered, published a story entitled Peter Thiel is Totally Gay. People, at that time, Thiel had not publicly spoken about his sexuality. He wasn't pleased. Still, his willingness to throw $10 million at Hulk Hogan's lawyers to bring down Gawker sends out a bigger message that those with the fattest wallets have the thinnest skins. Who can fill the role as defender of sites like Gawker from civil lawsuits that result in censorship or destroy such companies altogether? The Knight First Amendment Foundation, the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University would like to give it a shot. It's a $60 million effort to preserve and expand First Amendment rights. The Institute will support litigation in favor of protecting freedom of expression and the press. And Columbia President Lee C. Bollinger spent some time talking about his commitment to an issue that he says should concern everyone.
Well, the Gawker case has now taken on several dimensions. I mean, one part of it is there a right of privacy recognized within the First Amendment? Or should be recognized within the First Amendment. The second dimension of this Gawker case has to do with the funding of the litigation effort. And on that, I'm not one of those who is highly concerned about money being brought to litigation. I think this is a pervasive, long-standing sort of practice in the United States. The substance, the issue, how we should interpret free speech, free press in light of claims of invasion of privacy, that's what this case really highlights.
And does it bother you that Gawker and there are other kinds of media outlets on the internet who live off of playing the very edge of that kind of privacy sort of domain where they basically make their money off of titillating privacy-violating facts that are going to get onto their site and produce traffic? That's the business model.
So this is a very hard and complicated problem, John. I would say the following.
Well, you know what Jeff Bezos said today? He was asked about this today, like off the cuff. And he said, and he owns the Washington Post now, so he's a huge player.
Right.
He goes, well, if revenge is your goal, you're digging two graves, one for yourself and one for the person that you want to take revenge on, referring to Peter Thiel, who funded the Hulk Hogan lawsuit.
Right.
Then he went on to say that the only effective defense for a public person against things that are going to be said about you is to develop a thick skin, which is both support for Gawker and also a kind of grow up and everybody settle down kind of approach to the law here, which, you know, thick skin is not going to be a solution.
Let's start with the fact that in the United States, over the past 50 years, the country has decided through cases of the Supreme Court, and I think they've achieved a level of bipartisan support in the culture that's really quite impressive. I mean, there aren't many things that are really sort of basic values of the country that you can point to where there is a consensus across the ideological spectrum. But on this one, I think there is. And that proposition is that in order to have a really robust public discussion and a real self-government in the United States, a real democracy, we're going to have to accept that there will be a lot of speech that is deeply, deeply offensive, very harmful, and highly risky and dangerous in order to have the kind of discussions and speech that we want. I think the question today is, are we still committed to that general approach to free speech, free press in the United States? And I think we are and should be. And the second question is, do the new technologies of communication change the balance of values for us on that question? Should our rules, our doctrines, our principles be modified in some ways to take account of that shifting balance?
Do you think that the law has lagged behind technology in protecting whistleblowers and protecting people who come to disclose information because they believe that Americans need to know about it and that those individuals should be protected? Snowden, of course, is accused of treason.
So, John, you've hit on two of the most interesting and difficult problems, I think, that we need to face as a society, will face really over the next several decades. So on this one, every society has to decide where they are going to strike the balance between allowing the government to operate in some degree of secrecy and privacy and the interest of the public in knowing about what the government is doing. Those two values, those two interests have to be resolved in some way, and they're never going to be resolved completely one way or the other. So you have to design a kind of system for it. In our country, the balance was struck largely in Pentagon Papers, the famous case from the 1970s, and a few other peripheral decisions. The question today is whether the circumstances have now changed such that the balance should shift. So what are the different circumstances? Number one, Pentagon Papers involved several volumes of a history of the Vietnam War that Daniel Ellsberg, the government official, had to Xerox. Today, you can do hundreds of thousands of documents, really millions of documents, with the click of a button. So a lot more information can be taken from the government and handed over. Second major difference is that it's not the Washington Post and the New York Times that is getting this information and then deciding whether to publish all of it or some of it and listening to the government about what harms would happen from publication. It's Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, which are basically an anarchist kind of organization that have the belief that everything should be public, which I think no reasonable person would subscribe to. So the amount of information and the parties who are receiving that information and can make it public have now changed. And the question is, do we need a new balance? This is a major issue. And as I said, there's no question in my mind that this will reach the Supreme Court sometime in the next decade or two.
Lee C. Bollinger is Columbia University president and First Amendment scholar. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
So many ways to express ourselves, many new threats. Can we rely on academics and lawyers to be the sentries and protectors of free speech? Wendy Kaminer is a lawyer, an author, and free speech advocate who's more than a little worried, and she joins us from our partner station, WGBH, in Boston. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
How are you feeling about foundations giving money to institutions like Columbia University to protect the Bill of Rights? Everything's fine.
Everything isn't fine. I'm glad that the Knight Foundation is supporting a project on protecting free speech at Columbia. I hope only good will come of it. But everything is far from fine. President Bollinger questioned whether or not we still had a consensus on the value of free speech in America. I'm not sure we ever really did, but to the extent that we did, I think it has completely broken down. And I think that for a number of reasons, you can see it very clearly on college campuses. We have a movement going back 20 or 25 years now on campus to restrict whatever is considered offensive or demeaning or derogatory speech. We have rules coming out of the Obama administration that define harassment so broadly as to practically include any speech of a sexual nature that someone doesn't like or finds offensive. We have new technologies, incredible new technologies. And whenever you have technological revolutions, you have more anxiety about speech because technologies give more people more opportunities to spread their ideas much more widely. And we have never in history experienced anything like the kind of technological communications revolution that we're seeing today. And, of course, we also have the ever-present fear of terrorism, and we have ever-present surveillance, which has, I think, you know, a particularly corrosive and insidious effect because we are all virtually under surveillance all the time. If not under surveillance by the government, then under surveillance by corporations. And when people are under surveillance, they watch what they say. A couple of years ago, Penn did a survey of its own writers asking them about the effect of surveillance and found overwhelming concern about it and that writers were, in response, self-censoring.
Let me back up for a moment. I mean, the consensus that you talked about and that Lee Bollinger talked about, is that required for us to enforce this value of free speech? Above all, the framers didn't necessarily think that free speech was going to be something we voted on and that the consensus was going to determine. Isn't it the responsibility of the Supreme Court and the judiciary to hold fast regardless of what the ebbs and flows of consensus are?
No, it is the responsibility, obligation of the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution, which Supreme Court justices naturally tend to do, at least in part, in response to what's going on in the culture. Supreme Court justices come out of our culture, and they respond to what's in the culture. But more than that, if we depend on litigation and academic theorizing to defend our rights of free speech, we will find them evaporating very quickly.
Wendy Kaminer, lawyer, author, and free speech advocate. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Ethan Denault from Tampa, Florida. I don't believe there should be any limits on what we say and publish, barring the already limited barriers created by the Supreme Court. But we should not expect that everyone should accept and celebrate how we express ourselves.
Acushnet, Massachusetts, we have a wave of social media hate and anger because it's easy and anonymous, but when it crosses a point and reasonable people can agree on both sides, then it needs to be pulled immediately and connected accounts blocked. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Simple bath. It's something that the residents of Flint, Michigan haven't been able to enjoy for more than 2 years after the city contaminated residential water systems by failing to treat the water when they changed water sources. Thousands were subsequently exposed to lead and other chemicals. Doctors treated persistent rashes and hair loss. After national outrage and promises to clean up the water, scientists have recently told residents that unfiltered water, while still not safe to drink, is safe enough for hand washing and taking baths and showers. Lulu Brazel and Melissa Mays are both residents in Flint. Melissa is founder of the organization What Are You Fighting For? And Melissa, first of all, everyone wants to know, you've taken a shower, right?
I did yesterday, and I'm sorry that I did.
Really?
Yes. Yes, it's just hard to breathe. My hair color's changed. It burns your nose, your throat, your eyes. We received a shower filter from the plumbers, and it helps a little bit, but it's still way different. We spent a few days away in the Upper Peninsula showering with well water, which is hard, and it was a huge improvement to what we have here in the city.
Lulu, how do you trust government again, ever, after this experience?
I will never trust government 100% ever again.
So what do you do now? How do you recover from this and get a workable solution that's going to eventually lead to a water system you can trust, and then you can get around to the other problems in Flint?
Well, we need our entire infrastructure fixed. And until that's done, nothing's going to fix the water.
And what do you notice in your own home?
Here in my home, our water is blue tinted. It smells like bleach most days. If you're exposed to it for more than a couple minutes, you tend to start getting a headache. We have rashes that resemble chemical burns if we're in the water for more than a couple minutes. You have to do dishes with gloves on because it messes up your hands and arms. it's not good at all.
And they still are saying the water is safe for washing and taking baths and showers. That sounds like it's absolutely not true in your own home.
Oh, it's not true. They say if you aren't immune compromised or if you're not below a certain age, you're fine to bathe and shower in it. Would you shower in bleach? I know I wouldn't shower in bleach.
Melissa Mays, what have you been able to accomplish with your group? What are you fighting for?
We've had Mark Ruffalo's group from Water Defense in testing homes, and we've been finding across the board high phosphorus in the water, which is what they're putting in phosphoric acid to try to recoat the pipes. It's not working. You can't recoat holes. So instead of all that, all the chlorine and all the additional chemicals they're adding are causing all these byproducts to make our bathrooms like gas chambers. People are lethargic. Like Lulu said, the headaches are horrible, and you just feel awful when you take a shower. And we've limited it down to 5 minutes or less on a lukewarm shower, and it still doesn't matter. My kids have lost so much hair, and it's ridiculous for them to say it's safe when the state themselves are not testing hot water. So I'm asking, you know, how can you say it's safe to shower when you're not even testing the hot water? You cannot say that something's safe if you've not tested it, and they just don't listen to us.
You know, there's got to be a point where you just say, let's get out of here. I mean, I know that you've got problems, and we've talked about those before. But to describe again the limitations that prevent you from just putting Flint in your rear view.
Well, we own our home. And at this point in time, I don't think anyone's going to come in and purchase my poison water house. I'll never get what I owe out of the house. That's everybody said, just, you know, give it up, file bankruptcy. Well, my son's hopefully going to college in the next year or so, and I wouldn't be able to co-sign for his student loans, help him out in any shape or form. We would lose everything. So here we sit, but here we fight. If we give up and run away, they win is one thing, but also we can't run away as much as we'd love to. Like I said, we went to the UP and my husband had to drag me out of the cabin. And that's pretty bad because I do enjoy air conditioning and internet. But yeah, he had to drag me out because I didn't want to come back. But then when you get back here, you say, okay, well, this is our city. We live here. We love our city. And it's definitely worth fighting for. So we're not going to give up.
Lulu Brazel, you know, Melissa makes a great point that when the city fails and the state fails to support infrastructure in your community, every single investment that you've made could go down the tubes, right?
Correct.
And how's that affected you?
We don't own our home. We rent. But at the same time, we have a lot of money and time invested here. I've been here my whole life. There's so much good here in the city that we won't let the water run us out. We'll keep on fighting until they fix it.
What do you think they have to do? I mean, is it replace all the pipes? I've actually talked to plumbers who listen to the coverage about Flint and say, you know, give me a call. I'll get something done in a neighborhood, you know, over the weekend. I mean, he's oversimplifying, but there is a certain amount of head scratching as to why you can't just make a whole replacement strategy implemented in some reasonable period of time.
The only way that I think that our entire infrastructure will get fixed in a reasonable amount of time is if they bring in the Army Corps of Engineers, move everybody out, and get everything done at once. That way we're not disturbing chemicals and particles in the water every time they change the service line out. People aren't having to deal with the poison. Just get us out of here for a couple months, come in here, get it all done, and then move people back in.
And Melissa, what's your preferred strategy for dealing with this?
I work with the plumbers here in Flint, and they're ready to go. They're ready to call in the other union plumbers. There's 343,000 union plumbers that have said, we will come help if the money is there. We will get this done. But what we're told is that the governor said if he has to replace Flint's infrastructure, then he'll have to replace all the cities with lead or other water problems. And my saying is, that's great. Why don't you go ahead and invest in this and do this instead of allowing people to be poisoned and dragging out the torture, basically? But we're told if Flint gets fixed, then other cities are going to want to be fixed too, which, again, to me seems like common sense.
Melissa Mays, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Lulu, thanks so much, and good luck to you.
Oh, thank you.
Lulu Brazel is a Flint native, mother of three. Melissa Mays is the founder of What Are You Fighting For? And she's also a resident of Flint, Michigan. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In Haiti, a water crisis came disguised as an agency there to help. UN peacekeepers from Nepal arrived 5 years ago to avert unrest in the wake of a natural disaster. And after their compound contaminated the local water supply with raw sewage, 5,000 people died initially of cholera, and as many as 30,000 have died since. It took an investigation by journalists and scientists to uncover the cause of a disease that had never been seen before in Haiti, but the UN has never admitted responsibility for the outbreak or the deaths. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said the UN has a moral responsibility to help end the outbreak, but so far, UN efforts to fight the disease in Haiti are just 18% funded, not a great commitment, meaning the disease is likely to continue to claim lives in Haiti. Jonathan Katz was the first journalist to report the UN's role in Haiti's cholera outbreak, author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi.
Where do we stand in terms of UN complicity and the repercussions of this terrible catastrophe that was absolutely needless?
Well, the UN's position essentially hasn't changed for more than 5 years now. At the very beginning, they were extremely actively involved in a cover-up, literally destroying evidence and putting out press releases disclaiming any possibility that they could be responsible based on evidence and assertions that just weren't true. They convened a independent panel in 2011 to investigate the cause of the epidemic. And for the 5 years since that panel report has come out, the Secretary General and the other high UN brass haven't even acknowledged the findings of that report, which were pretty damning in terms of presenting evidence that the UN was responsible, solely responsible, for bringing the disease to Haiti.
What is the impact of the UN's credibility in a place where the UN has such a deep presence in Haiti?
Well, the impact has been huge. The United Nations' most powerful tool, really its only tool, is its moral authority. Its ability to intermediate disputes, to be a broker between different countries, and to say, look, this is the side of right. This is the side of humanitarian principles that we are here to uphold and that you agreed to uphold by signing on to the UN Charter. This is what they say when they're talking to other nations. And because the UN has failed so miserably to take responsibility for this catastrophe for which it's responsible, member states and other people look at it, frankly, quite rightly, and ask, well, what kind of moral authority do you have to intervene in other situations, which is really destructive when that's the main and very important power that a very important institution like the United Nations has.
What is the threat of cholera today? And because of the slow cleanup, will cholera now be a health hazard in Haiti where it never was before?
So cholera is endemic in Haiti. And like you've said, there was never a single documented case of the disease in Haiti before the fall of 2010, certainly not of the strain that the Nepalese peacekeepers brought that we see that's circulating there now. And it looks like it's an endemic disease now. People are still dying right now at a rate of about one per day. What those of us who were there during the initial outbreak in late 2010 and early 2011 really fear most is that we could see that kind of mass death again, where you have people dying in incredible numbers, bodies being put into mass graves. And even though the international community and the United Nations like to sort of claim some kind of weird sideways credit for having, while not eradicated the disease, at least made it so not as many people are dying again as they were at the beginning, they really haven't done anything because there's been no investment in water and sanitation infrastructure in a serious way to eradicate this disease. And so because it's still floating around there, it's essentially a loaded and cocked gun, and it just needs the right circumstances to pull the trigger.
Jonathan Katz is the first journalist to report the UN's role in Haiti's cholera outbreak. He's the author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
The first case of a baby born suspected to have microcephaly linked to the Zika virus has made it to the United States, widening the alarm despite efforts to contain this little-known pathogen. A group of 150 scientists around the world has signed an open letter to the World Health Organization urging the body to look more carefully into the effect Zika could have and possibly postpone or move the Olympic Games. Athletes have expressed similar concerns. Lee Eagle is a sports behaviorist and an associate professor at NYU's Tisch Institute. He co-authored the letter to the World Health Organization. Joins us to talk about the situation. Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
So what does this coalition of athletes and scientists and others mean to the Olympic Games?
What's really going on here is really more than just Zika virus and the outbreak. You've got to look at the whole picture. And that is, first and foremost, what's going on the ground in Rio and in Brazil. which is turbulence and turmoil in its economics, its politics, its society. And then we're talking about putting in a sports mega event on top of all of that. And that really starts to put questions to, what are you going to do about human resources? What are you going to do about financial resources? How's the whole thing going to be managed?
The World Health Organization released a statement that may or may not have anything to do with your letter, but it says that it's safe to hold the games in Rio and that it will not alter the international spread of the virus. So the games are fine and it's not going to spread the virus around the world. It sounds like they're not necessarily listening to your particular concerns.
I think that's fair to say. And certainly in the timing of things, maybe we can operate with the idea that there are no coincidences. Really, when it comes down to it, again, most of what we've been seeing and reading, including with the response from the World Health Organization, is that it's been very much focused on what the virus can or can't do, what it may or may not do. In terms of how it evolves, how it spreads. And again, we're looking at something even more than that. We're looking at the context. You've got to look at time and place. And this one just seems to be different.
What do athletes say about their own personal fears or coaches and the like?
I think there are certainly ones who are out in the public who are beginning to question and at least ask for more information. I can tell you that the athletes who I've spoken with certainly express a lot of the same questions and reservations, going, my goodness, I've trained my entire life for this. And now I've got to make a decision that really crosses the line between something professional and personal. And on its front, in the short term, how do you not go if you've been working toward this thing your whole life? Thinking in the long term, it's a bit of a different story.
What has Brazil promised in regard to specific countermeasures for Zika? And why do those not reassure you and others like you?
Well, I think some of the concern is not only about the resources that Brazil is putting toward tamping down the Zika virus outbreak now and in the time to come, but it's also about what's gone on already. So let's look at things like cleaning up the water in some of the areas where Olympic events will take place. At a point early on, it was all about getting the water clean. And then not so long ago, it just became, well, we don't have the time or the money to do it anymore. So we're just not going to do it. Hang on.
Who makes the decision on postponing the Olympic Games? Who has that authority?
And ultimately, it's the International Olympic Committee that has the authority to do something like postpone the Olympic Games. And by the way, it's not unprecedented. The Games were canceled during times of World War. Games were suspended in 1972 in the middle of the Games when the Munich Massacre took place. But certainly recommendations that can be made by organizations like World Health Organization in coming down the line on a decision like that.
Because this is a mosquito-borne illness and you can't necessarily just wash your hands and be assured of being safe, and there's no vaccine at this point, what's your worst-case scenario?
The scenario, let's say, to focus on is that this virus does spread, that people who travel into Rio, who travel around Rio as tourists, as residents, become infected, and that certainly the ones who live abroad would go back home and spread those infections.
Lee Eagle is a clinical associate professor at the Tisch Institute and co-director of the Sports and Society NYU School of Professional Studies. Lee Eagle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the climate everyone wants to experience, the open spaces and clean air of the American West. But when everyone wants to live there, too,
oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in.
Something has got to give. The Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, has warned that Western lands are becoming residential at an accelerated rate. This is from her message on the day this spring commemorating the upcoming 100th anniversary of the National Park Service.
In a new analysis by the nonprofit Conservation Science Partners, finds that natural areas out west are disappearing at the rate of a football field every 2.5 minutes. Football field every 2.5 minutes. So if you add all that up, you're looking at a pretty bleak picture. If we stay on this trajectory, 100 years from now, national parks and wildlife refuges will be like postage stamps of nature on a map.
Those figures come from a new report from Conservation Science Partners and the Center for American Progress called The Disappearing West. But Colorado's state historian, Patty Limerick, says that there has always been change in the American West and that our expectations and dreams of the West need to keep up with reality. Limerick says the sooner we get away from our myths about the West, the better.
Where is the West phantom like it flies before us as we travel? A famous Western figure once said. So that's a problem, which is where is the West? That is a moving concept in all sorts of senses of the word moving. And the word disappearing is an interesting term in itself because we're still here physically. There's quite a lot of it around me as I sit here in Boulder, Colorado. So it's good, I think, just every now and then to experiment with putting the word changing in the place of disappearing.
How much tension is there between private development and free enterprise and the preservation impulses of really the 20th century, which gave us the national park system, and which now we think about in the context of climate change?
There is a lot of tension between the pressures for development and the pressures for preservation. Acquaintance and friend wrote a book years ago called Witnesses to a Vanishing America, which was about melancholy and despair and a sense of loss over what was happening to the West in the 19th century. So we are not newcomers to that melancholy. And in fact, that melancholy, you could say, might have been tempered or has been tempered by the preservation movement, that there are so many places in the West today that are under some form of restriction of development and certain kinds of human activities. And that is a form of progress that I don't think we should lose sight of how much has been gained as well as how much has been lost.
How do you measure the loss of, you know, land that would be available for people to experience as not a human settlement, but as part of the traditional American wilderness and West?
Well, I'm probably a peculiar person to talk to about this because I am very aware of the last two centuries or more of change in the West. So I would certainly have my mind on what Indian people have encountered in the last two centuries and their claim on loss and also some important retained resources and land. I would also be thinking, for instance, about the fur trade boomed in the 1820s, pushed too far too fast in the exploitation of the beaver and petered out in the 1830s, and many statements of fur traders and fur trappers saying the West we had is lost, we are going to have to move on, we don't have what we had. All sorts of experiences in mining rushes where people come racing into the West and then feel that they got there just a little bit too late and missed the opportunity. So I am thinking about how many episodes we have had over the last two centuries of people thinking, well, now it's gone. That pattern of lamentation, that's really well established. We're certainly in a phase of looking around and thinking, what are we doing? I think that's good and healthy to be having that kind of reckoning. And this recent report is certainly very good at calling our attention to that. But I think there's something that might just be mind clearing to think about this longer two centuries of that kind of constant return to the notion that it's no longer really the West anymore and what we loved about it has gone away. That's not historically the most accurate way of capturing change in this region.
Do you think, looking at this report, that the political order in Colorado and, you know, more broadly, America at large is capable of the kind of consensus and pragmatism that will allow some balance to be achieved in the development tensions? Does this story have a positive ending, or is it inexorably going towards the North America is a parking lot scenario?
Well, the pieces and parts exist. Some people are a little bit disturbed now by a whole excellent movement of looking at the down-to-earth economic value and revenue of recreational economies. For instance, recreational fishing has come into a big role in keeping economies stable and healthy and giving local businesses a market. So we have really good studies about the economic value to neighboring communities of well-preserved public lands. So rather than going into a mud wrestling fight where we say, well, we'll either preserve it or we'll support healthy communities and give people jobs, we don't have to have that fight because we have evidence aplenty that valuing open space in its beauty and in its capacity to support wildlife, that generates economic value for surrounding communities. That makes it those places a magnet. Now, can we do it? Can we take in that kind of information, and can we stop the screeching and shouting matches and actually take that pause to say, well, what exactly are we fighting about? And my own personal opinion is it's 80% noise and 20% matters of real substance, important disagreement, things to be really reckoned with, and then a vast amount of overstated language. If we looked at some of these studies that say there's actually no particular reason to pit jobs against environment, because jobs and environment actually are shown to be compatible in all kinds of ways, I think we can do it.
Well, Patty Limerick, thanks so much for talking to us.
That was totally fun. Thank you so much.
Patty Limerick is the state historian of Colorado and the director of the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado. Well, here's something to take with you. This is your brain, and this is your brain on Facebook. Some researchers at UCLA literally put some teenage brains preoccupied with Facebook into fMRI machines to map brain activity during social media activity, and found that responses to photos and likes are tied directly into the pleasure and reward centers of the brain. And what's more, pictures with likes are more likely to get more likes, suggesting that teenagers on social media behave something like addicts who go along with the crowd, thus confirming everything every parent has been seeing in their teens for the last 7 years. So there you go. Social media makes teens behave like addicts. Great. Problem solved. Ever tried to get a smartphone away from a teenager on Facebook? Good luck with that. That's all for today. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.